I'm going to talk today about the Ewan sampling formula, which is a very famous formula in population genetics, and it also turns up in a lot of other places, particularly in combinatorics and in random permutations. So I hope you'll enjoy this talk. It's a very fun talk in a way, because it has a lot of interesting history to this particular sampling formula. It can be looked at in a lot of different ways, and I hope that even people that know about this formula will learn some things that they have not known before. Do stop me if you want to ask me any questions as we're going. In this particular model, we're thinking of the infinitely many alleles model, and so this is a bit different from the infinitely many sites model. And you might remember what we had last time was that if we're thinking about DNA sequences and we looked at the fine structure of those, we had the infinitely many sites model. So identifying them like this, we would know the whole sort of site structure of these sequences. But at the infinitely many alleles level, all we do really is identify ones which are different at the macroscopic level. So they're not, in a sense, two different models. One's a finer subdivision of the coarser model. So the model I'm going to talk about here, you'd think this was one particular colour. Then another one here would be a different colour. And this one here would be a different colour. But we don't actually look at the fine structure here of the DNA sequences. And this is the way it was in early population genetics, because we certainly didn't know what the sequence structure was. So it was very important then to think that you had a model where you always had a new mutation. So when you had a mutation, it was thought that it was always somewhere in a different position, which always gave you a different allele. But you didn't look at the very, very fine structure of the sequences. You just actually thought of the sort of coarse differences here of the types. Then if you do that, it produces a partition of the sample of N. So if you've got three of them here, they all work out the same. But in fact, you might have had another one, for example, like this. And it would be that white colour here. So your sample here would contain two of that one, one of this one here, and one of that one. So in that sense, it's a partition of four, the number four, into two, one, and one. And that's the way you can think about this problem.
But at this level, does it matter whether there's recombination?
It matters whether there's recombination, all right. So this model has no recombination. Yes, that does matter.
Or just labeling?
Let me think about it. No, that'd make a big difference. Yeah, because that would change the probabilistic structure of the whole system. Yeah, so that's a big problem. And even today, if you're looking at the core structure, it's not known what the distribution is when there's recombination. That's very hard. It'd be lovely to know more about recombination, but we just don't know. That's pretty hard. So it's nice to think of these as colours, and these alleles here are different colours in this picture here, what we've got. And this is a sample configuration of alleles, and we've got four of type A1. This is of type A1 here. We don't care what the colours are up here. If we're thinking about the infinitely many sites model, we certainly care, and we'd think that'd give us a fine structure. But in this case here, we're only looking at the bottom of the tree, so we don't care so much about anything up the top here, and you can think that this sort of wipes out the colours up the top here. And so we've got these mutations here, and remember, these mutations in the sort of model occur at a rate of theta on 2 along the edges of the tree. So we've got a Poisson process just putting these dots down on the tree, and every dot that comes is a new colour. That's the rule. So we've got to have all different colours here at the top. So here what we've got is four of this particular kind here. We've got one of that kind. We've got four of that, three of that, and we've got three pale blue ones at that end there. So that's telling us something about the sample configuration of alleles at the bottom of this tree. it's a quite a tractable process mathematically. We can work through a lot of things with this particular model. There's no particular labelling here. So A1, A2, A3 and A4 and A5 could be labelled any old way. You just actually got to have them different colours. So in a way, we don't really want to sort of think of a first allele, a second allele, a third and a fourth and a fifth. We just want to think that the sum configuration of the bottom, which is the partition of the N individuals in the sample. It's really a partition, and an unlabeled partition as well. This is Ewan's sampling formula, a very, very famous formula here. It's not quite in the way that Ewan's in fact expressed it, but it's nearly of that form. The probability of a sample having K types with BJ types represented J times, where the sum of J, BJ is N, and the sum of BJ is K, is this formula here. And I'm not sure how many people would have seen this formula or not. It's a very famous one. It's a bit unfamiliar to people who are not in the field. It's nothing like a multinomial formula here. So in this one here, the labelling is such that what you're looking at here is that you want to think about the multiplicities of the terms in the partition, in fact. So this is a typical kind of multi-set notation, in fact, in maths. Here we've got a set here. We want to say here that B1's 1. So what does B1 is 1 mean? It means we've got one allele here with a frequency of 1. There's no alleles with a frequency of 2. But there are two alleles with a frequency of 3. Here we've got A3 has 3 and A4 has 3. So there's two alleles with a frequency of 3. And similarly, there are two alleles with a frequency of 4. We've got this one and this one. So doing it that way, the sum of the B's must be just the number of different types here, and the sum of the J, BJ's, must be N. It takes a bit of time to get your head around this if you're not familiar with this multi-set notation, so please ask me. Yes.
So this question is this at some generation P? Or
this is in a stationary distribution.
I'm generating new colours every generation, so how come there's a steady state?
How comes a steady state? So that's a good point. Well, colours are lost by random drift. So if you go back, this is in the diffusion limit, but that's a good point. Why don't we just fill up with colours in this whole model in the population? Well, this is only in a sample, so we can only have at most N colours anyway in this particular case. But it is in the stationary distribution. And if we went to the limit as N tends to infinity, yes, we would have an infinite number of colours, in fact. But this is just a sample of N. But there is the point, a good point here. Why is there a stationary distribution? And the fact is, you're keeping on introducing new colours into the population all the time, but you're losing colours by random drift. So random drift just sort of loses the colours. So in random drift, remember, if you go back to the Wright-Fisher model, some individuals don't actually give birth. Some give birth and some don't. And the ones that don't get lost by random drift eventually. So you lose your colours by random drift, and new ones come in, and there's a stationary state there. It doesn't converge to a sort of constant proportion of mutations or anything like that. There's always a random distribution in the limit. So there's a stationary random distribution, but don't think that it just converges to a fixed proportion. It doesn't do that. It's always random. And we're just looking at the history of a sample in this coalescent tree going back. So I hope everybody gets this multi-set notation here. We think about it as a partition of N into these ones, and really the labelling 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5 has no significance here. They're just actually different colours or different alleles in this. So it's a distribution here on this partition, and we've used this sort of unlabeled multi-set notation to is probably familiar to you in maybe some physics context that you might be known of.
So just a question, the clarification between theta and theta over 2.
Why is there a theta on 2? That's just convention, in fact. The 2 is nothing particular here. It makes everything come out nicely in the formulae, so that's a good reason to have it. But it's not because of diploids. It's just a convention, unless any of the other geneticists have a reason for the 2. I guess there's no other reason than convention. It's come up convention.
Right there, we'd have to have a whole bunch of
as Dick says here, you have to have a factors of two all over the place, and it wouldn't be nice. So there's good reasons not to have. It's good reasons to have the theta on two, but it's a bit peculiar when you first see it. I agree. And in genetics, there's often factors of two left out, and when you come to convert to real time scales, you've got to be very careful. Okay. Oh, sorry.
So one more question. So this is this is normalized if I sum over k and over all possible partitions?
Yes, if you sum over all the possible b's. So the b's are the variables here, in fact. So if you sum over all the b's with these constraints here, you get 1.
But that also involves summing k from...
Yes, it involves summing k as well.
Right.
So k goes from 1 to n. You could just have one type, or you could have n types here. So while you're saying that, we should do a couple of calculations here with this. So the easiest one is here is if you have two genes here, just two genes, so n is 2. And if you want the... I won't try and get it from this, but if you want the probability here that you have a sample of A1 say, that would be the probability here that B2 is, you've got 1 with 2 genes, probably B2 is 1 when you've got it. When you've got n is 2, this is the probability that they're both the same, and this is the classical formula of 1 on 1 plus theta. In the early days, lots of people used to think about genetics in terms of pairs of genes. And the probability here that you've got A1, A2 is the probability here that B1 is 2, which would be theta on 1 plus theta. So here k is 1, here k is 2. But it gets considerably more complicated as you go on. There's one beautiful thing about this formula, and that is that what you have here is you can see that k is a sufficient statistic for theta, in a statistic sense. Chris might like this. K here is a sufficient statistic for theta. So that's saying that ideally, when you got your sample of genes, all you would have to do is work out how many types there were and estimate theta from k. And in fact, the distribution of k is known. So what happens with k here, it's a bit of an unusual distribution. The probability, I'll call it kn, is equal to k, is actually theta to the k s n k divided by theta to the n, where I'm using the notation here that theta n is an increasing factorial. These are Stirling numbers of the first kind, not the second kind. So I guess in the physics literature, probably used to probability distributions which are related to occupancy problems, where the Stirling numbers of the second kind come up. That's a classical occupancy distribution. But here, these are Stirling numbers of the first kind, not the second kind. when the Ewan sampling formula came up, it was Warren Ewens, of course, who published this, and he published a sort of a proof, I think it was fair to say, in Theoretical Population Biology, which was followed up exactly after his paper in 1972 by Carlin and McGregor giving an induction proof. But I think it really belongs to Warren Ewens, of course, as a sampling formula. So it's quite an interesting history. And Warren, of course, pushed this formula a bit. And it's counterintuitive here, because it says that if you come along and you've got your sample of genes and you've got N1 of that kind, N2 of that, up to NK of that one, you just throw away the frequencies and you say, I'm just going to estimate theta by the number of different types in my sample. And there was a lot of opposition to this idea when it first came out, because it's counterintuitive. And I guess, in a sense, this is probably not so robust. Why is it counterintuitive? To a geneticist who's actually got all his data, he wouldn't be very pleased about throwing away his frequencies and just using the number. And it's counterintuitive because
you can do better than that.
With this information, that's the best you can do, provided the model holds.
Okay.
But you can. It's clearly not very robust. It's clearly not very robust, because you only need something a little wrong with the mechanism, and you get more low-frequency alleles. And so it's not so robust. And so people used to use pairwise estimates, and they'd look at the number of allele pairs and see how many different, and then use basically this formula here to estimate theta. I'd use pairwise differences, how many pairs are different. So it's a lovely formula. It has an interesting history there. But this business that K being a sufficient statistic for theta is sort of important. It's an easy formula for the mean of theta. So the MLE is the moment estimate in this case. So MLE is moment estimate here in this case. And what you have is, if you observed K in your sample, say you observed K, then you'd have to solve... it's really the expected value of K in here. And so you substitute in the K that you actually get from your sample, and it would be 1 plus the sum from 2 to n of theta on j plus theta minus 1. And you'd solve that equation there to get your estimate of theta. Remember the different sort of formula you get in the Inflimini sites model. So the Watterson one, Watterson estimate here was that theta hat was a sum from 1 to n minus 1, the number of segregating sites divided by the sum from 1 to n minus 1 of 1 on j, where this was a number of sort of columns here which were different in your data set. This is a number of different sort of segregating sites here in your data set, like that. Both of these formulae here, the variance of theta hat decreases, but it decreases like 1 on log n. It's not a sort of 1 on n kind, or 1 on n or 1 on root n, something variance decrease. It's not a 1 on n variance decrease because of the connection through the genealogy. Yes, Chris.
So this is the same as the Chinese restaurant process?
This is coming. Yes,
in a word. Which makes more clear why theta should be related to K, just the total number of tables.
Yeah, so Chris is going ahead, which is good. There's a sort of another version of this from Jeff Watterson here, and this is thinking about the sort of distribution as you go up the tree, and you start looking at it, and as you go up the tree, what you have is old and new lineages. So you always start off with all old lineages here, but as you go up the tree, you might see that one's actually been formed by mutation. You're not really concerned about the lineages above this or above this one. So here we've gone, these have been determined at this stage, and we're looking at the time here across slice of the whole thing, and we ask, what's the distribution of these old classes yet to be determined and the new classes, which are the mutants in the sample? We're starting to look at it. Here we've got a slice at some time in the tree. And this is the sort of distribution which is a variation on this problem here. The probability of having this many genes of type L for L is 1 to K, and where this one, these ones here are ancestral, so these are the ones which are the old types, and these are the new types, the mutant types here, is this formula here. So this is known here, and it reduces to Kingman's partition formula when theta is naught. So what's this about here? Well, if theta is naught, you've got all old classes. You never have a new class because there's no mutation. So thinking about it when theta is zero, that's really telling you about the ancestral configuration. If I draw it on the board, it would be to do with this problem here. So Kingman's case would be when you take a time slice here and you've got these guys here, might have another one down here. This is the sort of partial tree that we've got here. And you want to know what's the probability here that you've got N1, N2 to NK in these classes here. I thought I mentioned this to somebody, but I thought I'd see whether the audience knows about this. Supposing you have a tree like this. This is a binary tree, and you can think of generating it by coalescing back in time, or you can generate it by branching forward in time. And suppose I label this here. If I label this 1 to 2k, I come along when this k edges here. Now I want to know what's the probability distribution of z1, z2 to zk. How do I do that? Does anybody know what the probability of z1, z2 to zk is? So the z's here have to add up to n. We've got to have z1 plus zk is equal to n, and the z's have to be greater or equal to 1, of course, to make any sense. Right, does anybody, not the person I talked to, but does anybody else know what the probability distribution of the z's would be? This is any general binary tree. It doesn't have to really be a coalescent tree.
Depends on time.
No, it doesn't depend on time. You just come along and take a slice. It doesn't depend on time because this is only describing the combinatorics of the tree. So there's the time intervals in between the branchings, and there's the combinatorics of how the leaves are arranged in the tree. This is only a combinatorial problem. It doesn't depend on time. You could have branching process trees or anything.
You're conditioning on that you've got to a point where there's a total of n.
You're conditioning on to where you... Yes, that's right. As Dick says here, you're really conditioning on the fact there's n here and there's k here. That's certainly...
So you're saying it doesn't matter how far back the k is?
No, you don't care. It's only a combinatorial problem. See, we've got to arrange all these things, so we've got a configuration with z1 to zk adding to n. We want to know what's the probability distribution of that. Does anybody want to tell me?
Given that there are k types to choose.
Given there are k types, see, we've come along in this tree, we've got k edges, and we've got n down the bottom. No. There's no theta anymore. There's no thetas in this. It's just combinatorics. Do you think it'd be sort of like a normal distribution? Well, would it be like a multinomial distribution? What would it be?
No, it strongly fits. I mean, one of them will have an order of half. Another one will have some fraction and so on.
So you think there'll be one big one?
Yeah, or one moderate size one. And, yeah.
And other little ones. What's anybody else think? Well, it's probably tough to spring you in this. It actually has a uniform distribution. It's almost counterintuitively. So the probability of Z1 to ZK is actually 1 on N minus 1, K minus 1. Absolutely uniform. And it's almost counterintuitive. You might think there'd be a big one or a small one. There's not. If you have K as 2, for example, if you had, say, K as 2, then you have a bunch of individuals here and another bunch coming here. So you take your slice here, and these two here are absolutely uniform. So the number here, Z1, would determine it, because you've got to add to N. So Z1 is uniform on 1, 2, to N minus 1. And you can get Kingman's formula here. So Kingman made a big thing about this thing when theta is zero. But in a sense, Kingman's paper sort of obscures what's going on here. This is the important point. And there are issues of labelling and unlabelling. So in this formula here, this is a labelled formula, because you're saying this is 1, this is 2, this is K. But in Kingman's partition, they're unlabelled. So you're not labelling them 1, 2 to K. So it's just a combinatorial term different there involved in it. But this is the basic problem. This is the basic sort of behaviour here. And I figure this is probably known for hundreds of years. I don't think it's very new. I would think people studying combinatorics knew this a long, long, long time ago. So it's an interesting thing. But interesting to see it in genetics, and slightly counterintuitive, possibly. I don't know what all these things are that keep appearing on my screen. Right. Come on.
You might need to click the middle and then press right here.
That seems to have hung. I think I have to restart it. Maybe I've got to use this. But it's not. Okay. What am I doing to get full screen? You know,
view.
View. Let's try again.
Is this those back or forward arrows? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't look fine like that.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Sorry. It's my ineptitude. Just a new Mac user. Okay, so some history. I'm going to actually prove you in sampling formula in a minute, but just some other connections here. So this is some history. Yeah.
What do you do actually with this Watterson formula practically in a genetics context?
Yeah. So it's It's telling you about sort of ones that are particular. How do you do it? You'd have to actually know some that roll, some are new, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes, it's unclear what you actually know. You don't usually know that when you come along, but it's interesting just to know the influence of the older ones on the whole sample. So you want to know maybe... See, this coalition tree is defined back to a common ancestor. It doesn't actually have to be, in fact. You could actually have a fixed boundary where you had initial types. So that's the case, you would be very interested in that because you'd have founders that hadn't changed by mutation. If you knew that a certain time back you hit something and there were certain founders, and you'd have to sum over the sort of distribution of founders and the distribution of new mutations, and it's telling you something at a sort of time slice back when you've got that many lineages, when you might have actually hit some boundary back. Then you might want to have time as well. You can easily put time in these calculations because time is sort of superimposed on the combinatorics. And typically people would say, oh, well, if you wanted to know what happened at time T back, you'd be interested in hitting T back. And you'd be hitting the time with a certain number of lineages in the tree. And then you'd sum over the ones, the genes, which are actually founder genes and the ones which are new mutations, and that gives you your current configuration. So that is important to be able to do that, and people do that. Yeah, but you, in a sense, you need time probably to do that calculation. Unless anybody's got some other use. Right. So this is some history here. This is Hoppe's 1987 EARN model, and it's a way of thinking about how you'd produce this one here. You start with one black ball of Mastheta in the urn, select a ball from the urn. If it's black, return it with a ball of a new colour, but if not, add a ball of Mass 1 of the same colour as the ball drawn. Okay, and stop when there's n non-black balls and label them 1, 2 to k, if k different colours. And that gives you the Ewan sampling formula. It's not massively deep if you think about it. It's pretty...
I'm confused about mass theta and
mass 1. Sorry? Oh, what do I mean by mass 1 and mass theta? Well, when you pull the ball out, the chance that it's a black ball, if you've got...
Well, that's theta and the...
Chance you've got a black one is theta on theta plus j, if there's j balls in the urn at that stage. Yeah. It's not massively deep if you think about it, because sort of looking back one step, it's correct. You can easily figure out that it's correct. Because you're sort of back in time, the chance you got a, when you've got n things, the chance it was a mutation is theta on theta plus n minus 1. And the chance it was a growth, which it was done uniformly from the ones existing, is just n minus 1 on n plus theta minus 1. So the sample paths, if you look back one, are the same as the sort of sample paths of the tree. And it's not that hard to believe that it's the same. It's fairly... Okay. This is the Chinese restaurant problem that Chris was talking about here. We've got people here, 1, 2 to n, arriving sequentially at an initially empty restaurant with a large number of tables. So this is Pittman's construction of the Ewan sampling formula here. We've got... sort of potential number of tables here, and person 1 arrives and sits at some table, and person 2 comes in here, and they might sit here perhaps at the same table, so that's sort of friendly, sit at this table here. Person 3 comes in, decides to choose a new table here. Person 4 comes in, might choose a new table. person 5 comes in, person 6 comes in, person 7 comes in, and so on. And we stop when we've got n people here. Then the configuration of people on the tables is the Ewan sampling formula. That's just another kind of descriptive way of saying that.
In the rest of this, there's usually another parameter. I remember where it's how populated is the table. It depends on the table. Is there any use in genetics of this other parameter?
There's some extensions of this, yes. Not so much in genetics, but there's some lovely extensions. I'll talk about one later. There's another way of thinking about it. You can do this actually from the tables if you want, or you can do it from this sort of forest. So we really have a forest here that we're thinking about. Like we've got a coalescent tree. We can chop it off here above what's happening here. So if we're going to look back in time, it's sufficient to really just stop the process here as soon as we've got a determined type. So instead of having a tree, we've got a forest here of these mutations. And we could do it in Hoppe's urn model, or we could do it here in the tables here, and we can think about random permutations, which is nice here. So here we'd start off with one here, and we'd start a new permutation here, a new cycle. So this is a cycle distribution of random permutation here. We've got to have the numbers here from 1 to n put down. So we can't avoid having 1 to n here. And what we're going to do here is put them in the same cycle here if they're branching here from the top. So here's 1 here. Then we'd start off by putting 2 next. So 2 starts a new cycle here. So new cycles are like tables here. If you want to, you can think about it as tables. It doesn't really matter.
A cycle is something like an increasing subsequence? Or?
No. It's just a random cycle in a permutation.
What does that mean?
Oh, well, if you were to draw it, you could draw it. You could come back here. So you go from 12 to 11 to 5 to 2 to 12. And you think it's a cycle. If you're drawing it as a graph, it's a cycle. This is a cycle notation in a random permutation.
This bottom thing is defining what the particular permutation is.
Yeah, it's defining what the permutation is.
It seems that the brackets are decreasing subsequences as well.
Yes, they have to be.
Yeah. Okay.
They have to be. Wait a minute. Yes, they have to be. Yes, that's true. In a sense, I mean, in the cycles that you get, they are, you're quite right, but they're not really ordered, in fact. So in the random permutation, yeah, that's a distinction. In the actual random permutation, they're unordered. It's just a cycle. See, it's just a sort of circle thing here. You go from 12 to 11 to 5 to 2 to 12. And you're from 3 to 3. Yes, they are ordered in that way, in the way you draw them. No, I get, maybe you have to have order. Maybe you do, if you're going to do a cycle. Yeah, if you've got a particular cycle, you have to have order. Agreed. So they are like that. And here, so you'd have to always order them in that way, in this distribution of cycles. And here, you do have a 1, then the next thing starts off a 2, the next one starts off a 3, and there's no more branching here. Then the next one is a 4 that starts here, but then things get more interesting. So 4 and the next one, 5, is the 5 one here is like a branch here. So this is the one that branches here. And they're all labelled here from 1 to n on the bottom here. So 5 is the one. Do they have to be ordered in that way? No, they're not ordered. It's getting me confused. No, they're not. They are actually ordered in this case, but no, they don't have to be, because these ones here are just determined.
Well, it's a set partition.
But you can also think of it as a random permutation, as a cycle.
set of numbers to prove permutation only permutes within.
Yeah, you can permute them within. Sure. Yeah, effectively, it's often thought of as cycle kind of distribution in this way. But in effect, yes, you could have them unordered. Well, okay, so we put the numbers here. We put them to the left. Yeah, they're age ordered in this thing. And so, now they're ordered in that way. So this is the one that branches here. The fifth one is here. And then we keep going when we do all this. There's another way. This is a random permutations idea here. If pi is a permutation with k cycles here, then we'd say that probably, you could say the probability that theta, under theta, that pi n is pi has this formula here. But then there's also a famous formula here that the number of permutations with b1 cycles of length 1, b2 cycles of length 2, bn cycles of length n is this formula here. This is a famous formula, and probably people know this. Is that true? And it's clear here that the labelling is unordered. Yes, to answer your question, get it right. The labelling did actually come, as you say, when it was decreasing, but you're really only interested in cycle lengths. You're not so much interested in the actual composition of the cycle. You're right. And so here, this is looking at the cycle lengths here, and this is the distribution of cycle lengths, a very famous formula here. And the Ewen sampling formula then is related to this cycle distribution. And if you put theta as 1 here, you'd get... So if theta was actually 1, this would cancel out with the factorial n, and you get 1 here. And the distribution... if you divide it by the factorial n here, you get a probability here, because this is the number of permutations. But the total number is factorial n. So if you divide by factorial n, you do get a cycle length distribution. And that's the same case with theta as 1 here, because this would cancel with that. And 1 on that bit is a cycle length probability distribution for random cycles. There's yet another one here, a birth process with immigration. With Joyce and Tavare here. Immigrants enter the population according to a Poisson process of rate theta, and then they reproduce according to a binary branching process. If each immigrant's a new type and the offspring are the same as their parents, then the sequence of states the branching process with immigration moves through is the same distribution of those generated by Hoppe's urn here. That's quite nice. Because people are quite used to branching processes, in fact. So here you just go on entering an immigrant entering and it starts to branch and then more enter, and you work out the families of the immigrants then at a time later, and you get the Ewen sampling formula again. So there are a lot of things that that give it, but the certainly massive interest in the cycle length distribution of random permutations. And Simon Tavare and Andrew Barber have done a lot more with this on their book on logarithmic combinatorial structures. Pittman's book on combinatorial stochastic processes is also very good. I'm going to think a bit more about this. So looking at the probability distribution of what's happening here, there's a forest of... what's happened here? Anybody help me get out of this? What do I do?
Click on the upper left.
Okay. Okay. So the probabilistic way to think of this is that going back here, you lose ancestral lineages here by coalescence. So you think that one of the lineages sort of survives and the other one's lost when you go back. And you lose them at rates I choose to, when there's I in the I edges here, or you lose them at rate I theta on 2 while there are I non-mutant lineages going back in time. Okay, so that sort of describes it here. And as soon as you get one of these kinds here, you just stop when you get a mutation. You get the mutation, you stop, and you do that going back to the right one here. And I want to label these here so that I1 is 1, I2 is 2, and IJ, IK or something is, perhaps IJ is K if there are K edges in the forest. So the I's tell you how many edges there are in the forest at the time in which they come in. This is a proof of the Ewan sampling formula. This is the proof. This is how long it is. I want to give you a proof here of the Ewan sampling formula. There is a further slide that explains this statement here. But apart from this, this is actually the proof. And you think that you're going to actually label the individuals from 1 to N in the leaves. So to give this proof, that's the first sort of statement. You label the individuals at the bottom of the tree in the leaves from 1 to N. Then somehow we have to work out the probability here that we have N1 to NK individuals in of the different kinds in the sample. Well, that's the possible assignment of types of N1 to NK, doing counting, to the numbers 1 to N, to the labelled genes at the leaves 1 to N. Then we have to have a factor here if we're unlabelling the types here, because B1 of them are 1, B2 are 2, and so on. We're not distinguishing between differences there. So we've got to divide by this because it's invariant under labelling within these groups here. There's factorial n ways that you could lose these genes, which are labelled from 1 to n, by loss of coalescence. So you have to lose them somehow by loss of coalescence as you go back. And there are factorial n ways of doing that by symmetry. Now, I'm going to come to this in another slide. This is the probability here that the ith gene lost is the last of its type. We've got to multiply this together. It's times this probability here that the ith gene is lost, it's the last of its type, or this one, if it's the jth last of its type for I as 1, 2 to N. So they're the things that need a bit more explanation here. Then, if you just multiply all those things together here, you get the Ewan sampling formula, in fact. So it's really quite a simple derivation if you can understand the combinatorics of it. This bit's easy enough, this bit's easy enough, so is that. And this is the only bit here that requires a bit of explanation. And things all cancel out nicely, and you've got this formula here. You can see here, the J here, when you're multiplying by the product of these, where J is 2 to N, what you will have here is a sort of... Well, you have to look at the different types. So you have to look at a type within the types. And these ones sort of cancel out with the NJs here. And you're left with these factors of 1 to the B1 up to N to the BN here from sort of products of these terms here, in fact, within the groups. It's probably too hard to see the algebra just sitting there in the audience. But it really does just give this... answer, and that is an entire proof of the Ewan sampling formula. Just really requires a little more explanation of these ones here. So this is this one here, of the last one being lost here. This is the probability of mutation on a particular lineage when you've got I ancestor lineages. So it has to be on this particular lineage to give you this configuration. And that's the probability it was a mutation rather than a branching or coalescence back. This term here comes from the fact that you've got to actually have coalescence back within this group, which is the same as branching forwards in time from J minus 1 to from I minus 1 here to get the J in the next step. And those two ones there are what appeared in that proof before. When we've got the term I here, that's because a particular one has to do the branching in this. So, yeah, I guess it's hard to see that in the board. My slides are downloaded if you want to have a look. But believe me, that's the proof. It's just actually those two slides and the Young sampling formula. I want to look a bit more in detail now about these particular I1 to IK. Remember, the I's here are the number of edges in the forest when you have a mutation. Yeah. And this is sort of not quite a linear forest, but it's going to represent the forest here. So it means here that you start off here with one type, then that type branches in the forest, so you put another ball down here, it branches again, and so on. Then you've got another one appears. Then the first one branches again, then the other second one that was derived branches, then you have a new mutation, starts off in the forest. So you think that this is sort of starting off a forest, and it's telling you the order in which one branch here. So this is telling us what we want to know. It's like a sort of forest. You can believe this is a forest, giving the order and what's happening. Is that all right? The idea? So I'm mapping the forest to a straight line here, and I want the order to be correct of the branchings. So when it branches, I add another colour, or I put a new colour when I'm starting a new tree in the forest. So it's coming down from the top to the leaves. Is that all right for me? Yeah. So I want to know, if I take a bunch of colours and sort of throw them down here, what's the probability that I get a tree? So I want to know combinatorial arrangements where this does come from a tree, a forest. Well, three, a forest. So what do I have to have here? Have N1 to NK genes here in this coloured dots, which do represent a forest. What's a necessary and sufficient condition? Well, I've got to actually have, I can always do this here if I always put the colours that are, if I take a colour, say like I3, this colour here, I have to put all the genes which are coloured that colour to the right. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. So I have to have enough spaces, in fact, to be able to do that. And it turns out a necessary and sufficient condition for this to hold is that there's enough really colours to put to the right here. All my other colours that are not yet there have to be put to the right. All the labellings here from 1 to IM minus 1 are labelled here from these events here. So I can only do this if there's enough spaces to be able to do this. In fact, this has to be bigger, greater or equal to this one here in this labelling. And so what's the sort of probability of an arrangement here? Where this occurs. Well, if I wanted to find the probability distribution here that I had this configuration here of I, this would be there's factorial n possible arrangements here of these numbers, but we've got to group them together so that there's a choice of nm ones to choose from the labelled ones 1 to n to initiate the colours for the eyes. So for each colour you can choose it from those ones there. Then you have to sort of fill in all the bits here with the correct ones. So all the colours in here have to be chosen from the colours which are derived up to this stage here. And the way to think about this here is at this stage here, Znm, Znu minus Im of these particular colours from 1 to m, which have been, which are still free, which are not used up here. So this is the total number of colours here which are initiated from here to here. That one, that number. Well, this is the number of sort of ones left here after initiating the IM colours up to here. So from 1 to M, these are all colours which are initiated up to here, M's 1. Then this term here is, this is a falling factorial here. So what's meant here is that it's going to be nu, well, it's n, the sum from 1 to m of nu minus im, then this term here, the sum from 1 to m of nu minus im minus 1, then it continues on down till we get down to dot 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 falling factorial sum from 1 to m of nu minus im minus I m plus 1 minus I m plus 1. So that's the notation, and this term here is just actually the sum from 1 to m of nu minus I m plus 1 plus 1. So that's the probability, in fact, that you have a configuration which is correctly coloured here with these numbers here. One thing you can do with this is you can get, for example, a Ewen sampling formula when you've got variable population size here. So if you're thinking about a variable population size model going back in time for the tree, and you said that you set it up so that this is the relative population size at time t back to the present size, then the way you think about the coalescence tree is that the rate of coalescence when there's I ancestor lines is now just depending on time, and has this formula here of I choose, this rate of I choose to land at t to the minus 1. You still have the same rate of mutations in that way. So in that way then you have a sequence of times when you do lose these lines still by mutational coalescence. And that depends on the sum of these rates here as to whether you lose them by how you lose them. So the t's have a distribution which is depends on this rate plus that rate there when there's I individuals going back in time. And if you plug it in the formula here, so you could say that the combinatorics here is independent of the time and work out the fact that you actually had this correct configuration here with the eyes, and the eyes tell you when the mutations occurred in this. So this is a formula here, and I probably won't try and derive this, which extends the other Ewen sampling formula. You can see it's very, very similar, excepting for this lambda t involved in it here. But that is is a formula which is thinking about the oldest, the next oldest, and the next oldest, and so on, because the A's here are ordered according to an age. There's an I1, then there's an I2, and an I3. So this is an age-ordered sampling formula for variable population size, in fact. And you'd have to sort of really take the expectation over these T's which would, if you wanted to do it in practice, you need to simulate what the T's were and do it by simulation to figure out how to evaluate that. Or maybe one would even want to simulate from the AIs, actually. If there's constant population size here in this age order formula here, where the eyes are, the order of the eyes is important, then you get this distribution here from Dolin to Varre here of the age order due in sampling formula. So to try and this comes from this size bias kind of formula here of summing over the AIs, but to try and explain this one here, this is giving the probability distribution of the numbers of different genes in age order. And so that's important here. So here, when you look at it here, there's an age order here. In one here is the oldest, in two is the second oldest here, up to NK, which is the youngest allele here in the sample. So there is this formula here that tells us, according to age, what the distribution would be. And it comes from summing these AIs here, because if lambda was constant, this whole formula here wouldn't depend on I at all. It doesn't depend on these ILs, the configuration of these I's here in the A. So the positions where you actually get these mutations is in this I, in the AI, which is in the ILs here. But if lambda t is 1, this doesn't depend at all on the AIs. And so this is the term that comes into it here. And this is a size bias kind of probability distribution here. You choose N1, and then you sort of take out the N1, and you choose N2. Once you've taken out the N1, then you choose N3 once you've taken out N1 and N2 and so on. And you can believe that's the way age works, because there's absolute symmetry in what's happening here with the genes. And so the chance that the oldest gene is of type 1 is N1 and N, in fact. And the chance that the second oldest gene is N2, given the first one is N1, is N2 on this sum. And the chance that the third one is the oldest is N3 divided by N3 plus N4 plus NK and so on. So this is the size biased ordering, which is the same as an age ordering. Yeah.
I got a little lost as to what one would do with this age ordered formula. Just the Ewens formula would use to estimate the theta.
Yeah.
How does one deduce the age of a given type?
Well, you might want to know the probability distribution of the ages, you see. This gives you the joint probability distribution of the ages and the frequencies.
Okay, but data is something we can infer from data. And what are the set of things where you are allowed to infer from data here?
So what's interesting here? Well, the simplest thing is that the chance that the oldest one is, well, say you come along and you've got frequencies, sort of unordered frequencies of, maybe I'll call them something different from the ends, but you come along and you see that you've got, say, frequencies, say, M1, M2 to MK. This is what you see in your population. And you want to know, what's the probability that the jth one is the oldest? Well, the probability the jth one is the oldest is mj on m, the sample size. That is the probability that it's the oldest allele, for example. And the probability that the ith one is the next oldest is going to be m minus mj mi. Given that's the oldest, then that's the probability that the ith one is the next oldest, and so on. It's a symmetry argument and a size-biased argument, because you're choosing them with respect to the numbers that are involved. That's a size biasing.
But at the moment, we're not making any use of sequence information.
No, No, why not? So the sequence information, if you use that, that's more of a gene tree problem. With time,
so
actually, it's more complicated.
Wants to use them, rather than using them to estimate theta, one wants to use them to estimate whether the model's reasonable.
Yeah, so I'm not talking about estimation so much in this. It's more the probability distribution. But one would like to know these things. I mean, you want to have a good feel for what's really happening in your data. And so you do want to know these things because you'd like to know. It's sort of important to have some idea as to what one would be the oldest. Yeah.
I guess maybe what I'm asking is I'm looking for some sort of a bootstrap that so you compute these joint probabilities. But then can you look at the sequences and construct your gene trees and see if what you get that way is consistent?
I don't know. That's
maximum likelihood.
Yeah.
Because otherwise...
that's too hard for me.
But how do we test it?
That's quite a hard problem. So your question is, how do you do the gene trees conditional on the frequencies? I think that's tough. Yeah. It's a reasonable question. I think the answer is going to be hard. There's yet another very interesting kind of connection here between record indices and record heights in an EARN model. So suppose, sort of think about this problem instead and come back to the model. What we're going to do here is take a box here. So you take a box, and in this box, you put balls here which are labelled 1, 2, 3, up to n here. It's a 3. And then start drawing the balls out. They're not independent because... they've got numbers which are 1, 2 to n in them. So if we start actually drawing out the balls and plotting them in the order in which we draw them out here. So here's the draws in. What we want to do here is to... So these are the numbers. S1, 2... Okay, so there's numbers from 1 to n here, but the S's are the record values in this. So in the first draw here, this is a record value. This might be the value 5, for example. Then we might draw the ball 3. Then we might draw the ball 6, which would be a record. So we just keep drawing the balls out and plotting them. And we look at the record values. This is a record. This is a record. This is a record. And we go down. This is the next record. And we come down to that one there. If we draw out the... If we drew out ball n, for example, first, that would be the only record. We just go straight down. So if the first ball was n, everything would be below it. There'd be no more records. If we drew out n minus 1, then it would be a record, and then somewhere there'd be n would be a record somewhere later. So there's a result here that says... if you look at these age-ordered frequencies here, given they're lost by mutation when there's these many genes, they're distributed as the increments here in the EARN model given I1 to IK. That's an interesting result here. So if you take the differences here, and the S's must be increasing because they're records, they're successive records, so they've got to increase. And if you take the differences then of those, they're actually distributed as the distribution of the age-ordered frequencies given the eyes. This is fixing the eyes, fixing where these records occurred. So, for example, here, if you look at this random permutation, so when you do this, this must give you a random permutation, because if you're drawing out the balls from this box here in some order, then that's equivalent to making a random permutation of the balls. So here's the random permutation effectively here, and these are the record values in this random permutation. There's 2, then there's 1, there's a 3, a 6, a 5, a 4, an 8, and a 7 there. So they're the record values in this random permutation, and The epochs here where these occur are 1, this one, 3, 4, this one, and then 7. These are the record values here and the sample frequencies given, the distribution given these ones here is 2, then it's this minus this, which is 1, this one minus this, 3, this one minus this, which is 2. So the idea here is to say, if you knew how many edges there were in the forest when these were derived, what would be the distribution of these frequencies? It's looking in depth at it. And you can believe what happens here if you let the n tend to infinity. The sort of draws this really like sort of uniform draws here, except they're discrete uniform in this case here. But if you let n to infinity, you get independent uniform random variables. And so there's a corresponding theorem here which says the following. If we've got partial sums here given these i's, so these are the frequencies in the population now, in this sort of limit population, the relative frequencies as the sample size tends to infinity given these indices here. So even in this sort of infinite case, we're thinking about an infinite number of leaves in this forest. So you think these eyes are sort of determined somewhere, and you've got a forest coming down, and you've got an infinite number of leaves at the bottom here. And there's an infinity of leaves, and the whole sample size, whole the population's partitioned by the relative frequencies of the leaves in these trees within the forest. And so there's a sort of limit theorem here. You can believe that they're record values in a sequence of independent, uniform random variables here, given they occur at these epochs here. That's just a limit, really, from the Earth, because you just have independence in the limit there. And there's a random partition formula here where these are independent here and... this one has a density of that form here. So you can actually get an exact distribution here, and given the i's, this is the distribution in this random partition. There's more generalizations of this, and this is the two-parameter Ewen sampling formula with a Chinese restaurant construction. There's another parameter in here. Imagine people arriving sequentially at an initially empty restaurant with a large number of tables here. Before the n plus one person arrives, suppose there are k occupied tables, and person n plus one sits at the same person as table I, with probably ni minus alpha on n plus theta. So it's a bit different. Or for each I less than n plus 1, or sets at an empty table with probably theta plus k alpha on n plus theta. And this is important here. So now the probability that the person sits at an empty table depends on how many tables are occupied. It's theta plus k alpha now divided by n plus theta. All right. So if we do add this up here, these probabilities do actually add to 1 here, you'll find. So this is the generalization. It's slightly different before, because alpha would be 0 in the other case. So the alpha is 0 case is the regular Chinese restaurant problem for the Ewen sampling formula. But here it depends on the number of types. Usually alpha is between 0 and 1. And the distribution of the configuration of people on the tables is this two-parameter Ewen sampling formula here, which has these extra terms in it here, where these are sort of generalized increasing factorials here, but they increase here with a weight of alpha on the item. So they're like increasing factors, but with that extra alpha stuck in there. It's quite a nice Pittman notation, in fact. So when alpha is naught, we get the regular alpha tends to naught, I suppose. We get the regular kind of thing. It's a nice generalization.
How is alpha related to the underlying sort of population process?
There's not any genetics in this. This is more a combinatorial construction that's actually stimulated by the unsampling formula.
But I guess I'm having trouble even. But is it related to?
Oh yeah, the alpha's related to. Let's go back one. The alpha's here related to the sort of a weight as to whether you start a new table. This is the way you think about it. So it's this K that's very important. So if there are K tables, then you sort of weight the probability that you get a new table with this K alpha kind of term. And this one.
So if alpha is positive, then it's more likely to start a new table.
Yes.
And alpha
is
larger than zero?
Yes. Alpha is usually between 0 and 1. It doesn't have to be, but... Yeah.
What do you mean, is usually?
Well, you can choose it. It has to be bigger than theta, but it could be negative.
That would mean it's more likely to.
Yeah, it could be actually negative here.
Already.
And yeah, you could have a negative, but the usual sort of case is between not one. But yeah.
So in genetics, it should mean something like the rate of creation of new species or something.
It's unclear what the genetics context is. But it's certainly an interesting idea that it could depend on the number of species, as you say, that are already there, in fact, or the number of tables. It makes some sort of sense. Usually alpha is between 0 and 1. What are the limit frequencies here? Well, the limit frequencies here have this partition problem, partition property here, that you're dividing them into. This is a sort of partition sort of formula here, a stick breaking partition, if you like. You divide it into B1 and then you look at the fraction of B1 and divide it into B2. Then you look at the fraction of B1 and B2 divided by B3 and so on. It's a stick breaking algorithm that you're doing. And there's a representation here that you put the limit frequencies in age order here, where the BIs are independent and have beta distributions with this property here. And there's one very important property of this process here. You can ask the question here, supposing you have a partition here, a stick breaking sort of formula here, where the Bs are independent and suppose you just have it like this and the Bs are independent. And you ask the question, what distributions can you actually have in which this distribution of the Xs is invariant under size biasing? And the answer is, you can only actually have the two-parameter Ewens sampling formula. That's all that you can have in the stick-breaking construction, which are invariant under size biasing. Now, I should say something about size biasing if people are not sure about that. Do you know about size biasing? Maybe I should say something about it. So size biasing is very neat. So here we've got these X's. We've got X1, X2, and so on here. And the sum of the X's is 1 here, like that. And we want to say, what is the size bias construction? What we do with this is say we choose 1 here, so we choose J. We choose say J1 first with probability XJ1. So we can think we've got these X's, and that's a probability here because all the X's sum to 1. So we put XJ1 down here. then we've got to choose another J2. And so we choose a XJ2 here with probably XJ2 on the ones that are left on 1 minus XJ1 and so on. So we keep doing that. And we keep choosing this sequence here, and we do it forever until we get the sequence. And the new sequence has the same probability distribution as the old one, is what's meant here. That's meant by saying it's invariant under size biasing. So if we do that construction, it has the same distribution, doesn't change. And that's a characterization of which stick breaking algorithms will give you invariance under size biasing. People get the size biasing idea. It's a neat sort of idea. You can do more on this. I'm going to just sort of skip this and just very briefly talk about the Poisson-Dirichlet process, which is an important limit process of the Ewen sampling formula. So you can think that if you looked at the Ewen sampling formula, and what we do is take nj on n and let n tend to infinity. And so we're looking at the frequencies in the population as a limit. So we take nj on n, j is 1 to k, and we let n tend to infinity, and we write sort of xj as the, well, as the limit as n tends to infinity of nj on n. Maybe we rank the x's here in order, so this is when they've been ranked from the smallest one to the largest one. So we're just looking at the limit in this Ewen sampling formula when n tends to infinity. And we're looking at relative frequencies now rather than absolute. They converge to what's called the Poisson-Dirichlet process. You still add to 1, and there's always one frequency here which is the biggest. Then the others go right down. There's a limit point of 0, because you've got an infinite number of them adding to 1. You've got to have a limit point at 0 here. There's a lot of lovely work on this. The book by Ratio, Barber and Tovare on this logarithmic combinatorial structures is very, very interesting. And Pittman's book here is very interesting. And Kingman's little book on Poisson processes is a lovely little book as well, which includes this. How can you actually get this process here? Well, if the y's are a non-homogeneous Poisson process with a mean measure density of this form here, and then you just rescale it here, then the x's have that distribution, and y has a gamma distribution as and is independent of the xi. I think I'll just say something a little bit about this. And what's the idea here? So in this process here, in this Y process here, this means here that it's just a sort of Poisson distribution for the number of points. And if you took, say, if you look in the line here, so this is the Y process, which is going from 0 to infinity here, and the X is going to be the scale process here. So for the Y process here, if you took an interval AB here, then the probability that you've got J points in here, J points in AB, would just be the integral from, well, it's a mean in the Poisson. So it's lambda AB, the J on factor of J, e to the minus lambda AB, where lambda AB is just the integral from A to B of this function here, theta y to the minus 1, e to the minus y dy, like that. So that's telling you about what's happening in the y process here. And in particular, if a tends to zero, then this integral diverges because there's an infinite number of points at the limit around zero. But typically here, in the y process here, there's a sort of infinite number of points here, but there's one maximal point here. You can see there's a maximal point here because if b tends to infinity, this mean is finite. This converges here. As long as a is away from zero, you put b as infinity, this is finite, the mean number of points is finite, which means that you can only have a maximal point, because if it were, if you had an infinite number, you'd have it going out further. So there's a maximal point in the y process, and you're rescaling things to make it independent, like that. You may not be aware of what this sort of Poisson Dirichlet process is about. Let me try and explain a connection to the Dirichlet. It's really very a lovely extension to a sort of finite case. Supposing what we have is that y1, y2, to what will I use, yd here, are going to be independent a gamma epsilon random variables. And what we've got here is that the density of these variables is just going to be y to the epsilon minus 1 on gamma epsilon e to the minus y, where y is greater than u, 0. The usual just sort of independent gamma random variables. Then if you take the ratio here, supposing I put xj to be yj on y, and y is going to be the sum of the yj's. So y here is y1 plus yd here. And if I put xj as yj on y, then it's a classical theorem that you probably know, that xj is Dirichlet epsilon, all the parameters epsilon, and independent of y. And y has a gamma, y is a gamma d epsilon distribution, like that. I'm not sure whether people know this or not. They probably do. Is that familiar to people? No, okay. So this is a very sort of classical kind of thing. So the density, the x's is like sort of, the x's have a density of x1, the epsilon minus 1 up to xd, epsilon minus 1, constant like that, where the sum of the x's is 1. That's a sort of classic result here. And the Poisson Dirichlet process here is a limit result of this. So for the Poisson Dirichlet, is when you take theta is d epsilon and you keep that fixed, and epsilon tends to zero, d tends to infinity, and you think of the Dirichlet as a sort of point process where you order the points. So you just actually got d points here which add to 1, and you write them in order on the line. And as d tends to infinity, you get this limit, which is the Poisson Dirichlet process. But it does come from just this simple kind of construction here of scaling the gamma random variables to get it right. You can get the Ewen sampling formula by sampling in this distribution back again. I won't talk about that. But I will talk about this size bias kind of Poisson Dirichlet distribution, or it's called the Gem distribution as well. This is rather like a stick-breaking algorithm we had before, and it's a bit simpler, in fact. So if you arrange things, so you take Z1, then you split up Z1, you split it up again, and split it up again, do it in the stick-breaking algorithm, then this is a sort of size-biased construction then of the Poisson Dirichlet, but it's also the age-order distribution of the allele frequencies. So the probability distribution of the oldest in the population is X1, the probability of the second oldest is X2, and the third oldest is X3, and so on. So this is a nice construction in that way. I think I should leave it there. Don't forget that Marty's on 12:15. The slides have been uploaded to the website, and there's more involved as well on those.
Historical/nomenclature question. So hobby equals Uman's equals Chinese restaurant process with alpha equals zero, or are those three different?
No, they're all alpha zero. Is Pittman's the one?
Those are all three the same process.
Pittman's the alpha case.
Sorry?
Pittman is the alpha case.
Okay, I'll call it Pittman if there's
another. Yeah.
Can you have another go at saying what size bias means?
Okay.
What you mean by that stick breaking process. I understand that the first one is usually the first one's not bound to be the biggest by that rule, right?
Let's try this one again, try and understand this again. So it says, in fact, this is actually invariant on size biasing if you had it like that, but if you just had the Poisson Dirichlet one. So supposing we look at all the Poisson Dirichlet points, and we've got these Poisson Dirichlet points here on the line. Here we've got them all. There's the limit point here. And then there's this sort of big one here, x1, there's an x1, x2, and so on like that. And we haven't really got any idea what their age distribution is at this stage. We just see them as points, and these are representing allele frequencies in the population. And this is the limit of the Ewan sampling formula in the population. And we want to know the age distribution of them. So, for example, the probability that that one's the oldest is X1. The probability the Jth one is the oldest is XJ here.
So this is just based on the fact that they are all equally likely to be.
Yes. This is a very, very, very symmetric kind of argument. And so if you wanted to order them in a size-biased order, as Paul was saying, how do you actually do it? Well, you choose one of them for a start. You choose sort of X, J1 as the oldest. Here it was probably X, J1. And you say that's going to be our first one. So here we've got X, J1, that's the oldest. Now, to choose the next one, you'd choose a sort of XJ2. And you choose that from the ones which have the J1 removed. So you still have frequencies which add to 1. So you choose it with probably XJ2 divided by 1 minus XJ1. Okay. Then you choose the next one. The next one would be J3. It's probably XJ3. You've arranged them in a different way. 1 minus XJ1 minus XJ2. That's how you choose them. So you keep choosing them by just rescaling what's left. It's a sort of inverse of the stick breaking thing. You choose this one, then you take that one out, and you choose the XJ2 proportional to all the ones with this taken out. And you do it again and again and again. So that gives you a different ordering of these points. It gives you an age. It gives you the size biased ordering, which is actually the same as the age ordering. It's not quite clear, but it's almost clear. And so And the age ordering has this sort of constructive distribution. This is the distribution of it. That's not obvious from what I say there. There's another step to get that that's true. The fact that this is a distribution is not obvious by me just saying that. There's work to go from this construction to that, but it's true. Okay.
I think what you just said is that if you do this process, this gives you some order of
ages. This gives you this distribution here.
Ages.
Yeah.
And that's more or less in the order of decreasing in size, but not exactly because
it's not quite.
Not
yes, that's right. What Paul says is important here because if you took the expected value of this, so the expected value of z, the expected value of, if you look at the expected value of 1 minus z here, that would be, well, it's just the integral of 1 minus z with respect to that, which is theta on 1 plus theta. So Paul's comment is that the expected value of x in this representation here, the jth oldest, what's the expected value of the jth oldest? Well, it's actually 1 on 1 plus theta, theta on 1 plus theta, for j minus 1. So that's telling you something very practical there in that sense. That was Paul's comment. So the frequencies of the oldest, next oldest, and so on decrease geometrically like that. I haven't tried it in the two-parameter model. It's a little different.